The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
So for the next few weeks, what are you thinking for topics? You got any ideas?
I don't know. I mean, a big one we haven't hit yet is the Fermi paradox.
My vote is for the robot uprising.
Conspiracy paradox. For the last time, we're not doing that. Fermi paradox, though, that actually sounds pretty good. I think we need to do a big guest for that one, though. It's a big topic.
Completely agreed. You know who would be perfect?
Tony Danza.
No.
We're going to have to agree to disagree on that one, though.
I mean, he is the boss. No, I'm Josh Clark from Stuff You Should Know. I don't know if you heard it recently. He did a 10-part series called The End of the World.
Oh, absolutely.
He explored the existential risks to mankind. He actually did an entire episode on the Fermi paradox.
I'm intrigued. Tell me more of these existential risks.
If mankind goes away in the next... Never mind. Why am I telling you? But these are your aspirations and dreams. You don't need to be talking about it. Anyway, getting Josh would be awesome, but I'm pretty sure he's probably too busy for us.
Plus, I doubt he'd want to slum it and join this ham and egg operation.
Never know until you try.
They say I'm disturbed.
From city to city, an incredible hysterical panic spread.
I think we're getting into a weird area here.
Well, you silly fools are not crazy! Not crazy.
This hysteria.
You can't handle the truth! Truth.
Brain is gone.
This is Hysteria 51. The truth is out there.
It's alive.
But you won't find it here.
They're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
Welcome in Hysteria Nation to the podcast that's never proven the existence of aliens. But how else would you explain Giorgio Tsoukalos' hair? This is Hysteria 51.
Is it coincidence? I think not.
Broadcasting from the lower fourth dimension, otherwise known as Chicago, we're your hosts and captains on this interstellar exploration. I'm John Goforth, and this is Brent Hand.
John, tonight we get to the heart of the matter. Where the heck are the aliens? And normally we'd have a guess for it, but this week...
Hold on, guys. I brought you a guest.
That other voice you're hearing is the third host of this show, an angry robot bent on world domination. He is the one and only Conspiracy Bot.
You know, I built Conspiracy Bot in my lab to help produce and edit the show. Instead, he's pretty much just a drunk. See, Bot, what in the world is in that box?
You mentioned that guy from Stuff You Should Know. I went and got him.
Wait, you did what? Josh, is that you?
Hey, guys. Sorry, I'm a little groggy. The last thing I remember, I was having this fascinating conversation with this robot about killing off all humans.
Huh.
We were sharing this basket of buffalo chicken tenders, now, and now I'm here.
There it is.
He's the one who bought the chicken tenders.
There's the problem.
Yeah.
See, never take any food from that guy. And since you're here, though, number one, you've learned your lesson. You mind joining us for a bit? We're talking the Fermi paradox.
Sure, that sounds great, but wait, where am I?
Well, you are here in the lower fourth dimension, otherwise known as Chicago.
Oh, and it's such a beautiful time of year to be here, too.
It is. A free trip to Chicago, that's all right. I can deal with that.
All right. For those of you who live under a rock and aren't sure who Josh is, he, along with Chuck Bryant, hosts the largest podcast in the known universe, Stuff You Should Know.
Now, known universe is an important thing that you put in there, considering this week's episode.
It's very... Very true. The unknown, the portion of the universe whose light has not reached us yet, could have a bigger podcast.
They're not even in the top 50% when you get down to brass tacks. But, you know.
If I'm not mistaken, Josh, your little show over there just surpassed over 1,000 episodes and a billion downloads.
Yeah, we're coming up on close to 1,200, I would guess, by now.
Wow.
And as far as we know, we're the first podcast to ever cross a billion downloads. We were the first one on Apple Podcasts to hit 500 million. So We've been at it for longer than almost every other podcast out there, so we've got a lot of years under our belt, but we're pretty proud of those numbers.
Do we call you Grandpa, Papa, Pop Pop?
Pop Pop is what I prefer. Just because you call it that tells me that you're not ready for it.
Now, obviously, we're huge fans of the show, as is most of the known podcast community, but I think maybe even more relevant to our conversation today, a show that you put together more recently that
our listeners are probably familiar with, familiar been running
the promos. Yeah, The End of the World with Josh Clark. Amazing show. It's 10-part series. I mean, you explore the Fermi paradox. I always say Fermi, and I know it's Fermi, but really the premise of the show is the kind of the existential risks to humanity.
It focuses, like you said, on existential risks, which are catastrophes, disasters, threats that are so big, so huge, so sweeping in scope that they are capable of actually bringing about the extinction of the human race.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's the kind of thing he was saying when we were having our conversation over the buffalo chicken tenders.
Those delicious, delicious tenders.
They were pretty good. So we're not used to these kind of risks, right? Like things like catastrophic climate change or even all-out total nuclear war. These would be really, really bad for humanity. But a lot of people argue that we would adapt, that there would be enough people left over to survive and rebuild, and that eventually, thousands or maybe even tens of thousands of years down the road, we would get back to about the point where we had left off.
Right.
So existential risks are different than that. They don't allow us to rebuild. There's no do-overs. There's no learning from trial and error. If one of them happens to us once, that's it for humanity. And there's a lot of risks coming down the pike right now in the form of some of the technology we're working on, like AI, some biotech experiments, nanotechnology, possibly geoengineering, and some other stuff we haven't even thought of that we need to start planning for now, or else we may accidentally wipe ourselves out with one of these new technologies.
Now, this is going to sound like a horribly morbid question, but what's your favorite? Like, if you had to pick a favorite, if that's a way to put it, like, what was the one that you covered that you're like, oh, this is crazy?
I love all of them. I just think they're all just so fascinating. And then,
I wish you would have said, I love all of them.
they're all kind of my children, you know?
Yeah.
I would say the one that gets me the most are the physics experiments. The idea of, you know, turning on a particle collider some year down the road where, you know, we've just reached these incredible speeds and energies in whatever particle colliders we build 50 or 100 years from now, and just flipping the switch and then that's it. Lights out. The universe is just over. We accidentally not just wipe out humanity, but we accidentally erase the universe through, you know, some form or fashion, and some exotic particle we've created or some accidental slip of physics because we don't fully understand it yet. That's just fascinating to me. But again, I love all of them. And I think it comes through in the series that I was really interested in every single one of them because I really go in depth for each one.
And the level of research, it must have taken you a long, long time. Much, much different from this operation where we likely don't go past the first page of Google.
Unless you're, no, that's not true, because my wife is like, do you have to buy a book every week? I'm like, yes, I do. Yes. And she's like, well, if we die, we're just on vacation, and someone comes in and sees our library, they're going to be like, what the hell was wrong with these people? It's all serial killers and like into the world and AI and ghosts. It's like, uh-oh.
But yeah, that makes you interesting, though.
Right. That's one way to put it.
So, Josh, you actually kind of put the ball on the tee. You mentioned the particle accelerators. There's one not too far from us here in Chicago called the Fermi Accelerator. Yeah. And
you said it right. Fermi. I say Fermi all the time. Fermi Lab. It's Fermi Lab.
Fermi Lab.
I think at this point, Enrico Fermi doesn't care how you say his last name.
Yeah, right.
It's fair. And the reason that puts the ball on the tee, that transitions us into the topic today, the Fermi paradox. Now, guys, this is going to be a roundtable for us to talk through all the different ins and outs of the Fermi paradox, the possibilities, etc. But before we do that, let's just set the table for everyone. If you're not familiar, folks aren't familiar with it, and a little bit of background behind
it. Yeah, we got this gorgeous cat named Enrico Fermi. He was a Nobel Prize winner who built the first nuclear reactor, and he was having lunch with his friends at a little place called Los Alamos. Now, you know that, fair listener, from all of our Bob Lazar episodes.
Or almost every other episode. Yeah, Los Alamos is always involved.
So according to eyewitnesses, they were chatting about a cartoon in the New Yorker showing cheerful aliens emerging from a flying saucer carrying trash cans stolen from the streets of New York. And Fermi asked, where is everybody?
And everyone realized he was obviously referring to the fact that we haven't seen any alien spaceships, or at least proven that we have. And the conversation turned to the feasibility of interstellar travel. The challenge with this whole conversation was that it's all somewhat third hand. Fermi never printed anything about this, wrote anything about this. It actually comes from other people who were at the lunch. He didn't have too much of a chance to. The lunch happened in 1950. He died in 1954. A guy by the name of Herbert York, who was there, seemed to have the clearest memory, saying, quote,
He went on to conclude. That's how I like to think he talked.
That's a great Herbert York.
He went on to conclude that the reason that we haven't been visited might be interstellar flight is impossible. Big boo on that. Or if it is possible, always judged to be not worth the effort, or technical civilizations don't last long enough for it to happen, which are all things that we've kind of touched on this show.
Absolutely. And we'll get to that. We'll get to the possibilities of why or why not. But first, let's set up why that when we look up into the stars, we don't see an intergalactic smorgasbord of ships and life and just everything that would be involved in Star Trek, let's say.
Well, I can tell you right now, we've already had experts, they said, on our show that told us that's because the firmament that covers the dome of the flat Earth blocks all that out.
Oh. Oh, well, episode over.
Yeah,
Josh,
we're done there.
You can leave.
thanks for dropping by.
So before we get into the why, let's cover some numbers that gives this thing relevance. You need to understand the scale to understand why this is such a
paradox.
And
an important thing, I think, to put on that is you can't understand the scale.
No, you can. Yeah. I mean, just wrapping your arms around this. The known universe. And again, we say known for two reasons. One, light since the Big Bang has only had so much time to travel to us. Any light that hasn't made it here in that amount of time, that's the unknown universe. Two, various theories on this. Some people believe that the universe is ever expanding. That said, the known universe is 90 billion light years. By comparison, the distance to the closest star to us is 4.367 light years. So to reach Alpha Centauri, if you used a spacecraft like one that we have available to us today,
with speeds available to us today,
it would take about 78,000 years to get to the closest star.
That's just such a defeating number when you think about it. You know? It's not even like, well, we'll get there.
Well, we'll pack a lunch.
Yeah. Yeah.
In other words, the known universe, it's just too big to fathom. Right.
This is a point that my wife and I, we always talk about. I'll tell her about the stuff that we're talking about on the show, and she just like goes glassy. She's like, I don't get it. I don't like talking about it. I'm like, why? She's like, I just don't understand. She always says this, that she's staring at me from the production booth. I don't understand space. I don't get space. And I'm like, well, it's just space. She's like, yeah, but the numbers are too big, so I'd rather not talk about it. You know? And I get that. I think that's a lot of people, when you just don't understand something because it's such a grasp, you just block it out. But luckily, we had people like the scientists that we've had that go, no, I want to actually figure it out.
Well, the thing about space, though, is even if you do grasp the numbers, it doesn't really help. It just makes you feel even smaller and less significant and even more confused, really.
It's like the you are here picture when it's just the Milky Way, you know, it's just got a little arrow. Have you ever felt more insignificant, you know? I know John has, but I don't know if you have or not, so what are you doing?
But you guys bring up a good point. I mean, you think about it, in the known universe, there's at least 100 billion galaxies, each of which has at least 100 billion stars, if not many more.
Yeah, they think there's actually probably a lot more than that. We just don't know for sure.
Right. I mean, because a lot of this is just computational guessing. So for the purposes of this conversation, let's keep it local. Let's just go down to our little neck of the woods, our galaxy, the Milky Way.
I prefer Snickers.
Yeah, that's gross. Not a fan.
Actually, I don't like Milky Ways.
I do like Milky Ways. I don't like Snickers.
I like them both. Why choose? Life's too short. Life's too insignificant to have to choose between Milky Way and Snickers.
There you go.
Touche, touche.
I've got a Snickers over here for you, Josh, if you are hungry again.
Thank you very much, but no.
He'll save it for the ride home.
Yeah. Fool me twice.
So just in the Milky Way, we have at least 400 billion stars. Scientists think that stars like our sun, for various reasons that it would take an episode to go through, are the most likely to support life in our respective solar system. So there are about 20 billion of those, give or take, in the Milky Way. Estimates are that about 20% of those, or about 4 billion, have potentially habitable zones for carbon-based life, planets in the respective Goldilocks zone.
Now, that's because, as we look at it, we only know of life being carbon-based. That does not mean that life is only carbon-based.
Absolutely.
That's a great point.
That is what we've seen, and it's a lot easier to grasp things in your own view. There could be energy and silicone-based and just, I mean, crazy amounts of life that we haven't even thought of.
Methane-based octopus floating around on Jupiter.
That's right. That's right.
All right. So if only 0.5% of those planets that are in that Goldilocks zone in the Milky Way actually developed life, there would be 20 million planets with life in the Milky Way alone.
But look at the problem with that I see, not a problem, is what we're talking about. Look how big the Milky Way is. You got 20 million planets dispersed through it. You're so far away.
Right, right. Another way to talk about, that's the Milky Way. Another way to talk about scale that's just like one sentence. When you think about the known universe, think about every grain of sand on every beach in the entire world. There are at least 10,000 stars out there for every grain of sand.
Whoa.
That is staggering.
That, I mean, now try to wrap your mind around that number. No thanks, I'm good. So with the high probability that some of these stars have Earth-like planets, and if the Earth is typical, some may have developed intelligent life.
The Earth is typical is a whole other conversation as well.
Right, the whole rare Earth thing, right. Yeah. But some of these civilizations, at some point, because of the universe is so old, may have developed interstellar travel like we are working on now. So even at the slow pace of currently envisioned interstellar travel, like how long it would take, the Milky Way galaxy could completely be traversed in like just a few million years. Mm-hmm. So if you follow that whole line of reasoning, the Earth should have already been visited by aliens. Period. Full stop. So to echo Enrique Fermi's point, where is everybody?
I mean, we're going to get into those whys, yeah. But there's a lot of possibilities as to why they haven't, or have they? Because if you listen to a lot of our episodes previously, they're here in spades, you know, every other day, just probing and crashing every once in a while.
Crashing, yeah.
A lot of people are like, what do you mean, where are the aliens?
Yeah, exactly.
Open your eyes.
Yeah, we just angered a lot of people.
I've answered this for you. I was on Geraldo, and I did so.
Yeah. Geraldo. All right, so, John, I think you set the table pretty well. We're going to go to break real quick. When we come back, we're going to get into the potential explanations of where other intergalactic brethren are at out there in the cosmos, coming up on Hysteria 51. Hola, David. Me amo Brent.
Bonjour, Brent. Je m'appelle David.
You didn't do Spanish. I thought if we were going to do this together, we'd do the same language.
Oh, sorry.
that's on brand for us.
I just thought romance languages was the key.
Everything I say is romantic, and that is thanks to Rosetta Stone. You guys, we've been touting these things forever. We love Rosetta Stone, and we actually are users. David, you've really been using it even for longer than I. What's your experience been like?
Oh, it's been great. The thing is, you really get to learn how to speak and think in that language with it. So it's very high on pronunciation, too. So you can, you know, learn how to speak.
And, you know, our show is all about proper pronunciation.
In that pronunciation. Yeah, that's right. But they design it for long-term retention, you know. If you don't get the pronunciation right, you say it until you do, and then, you know, that just seeps into your head.
Well, and that's why, you know, this has been trusted by experts for 30 years, and There's over 25 different languages that you can learn, and people, millions and millions of users use it because, like you said, it does seep in and you're using it with, you know, you get speech recognition and it hears you. You get to use like the built-in true accent features that gives you this pronunciation, which is super convenient, and you can do it at your own time. And I don't know if you know this, but I'm all about value, and you get a one-time purchase, 25 languages. If I learned all 25 languages, I'd be so confused or really cool. I'd go in and out.
But you'd be real marketable.
But literally, though, this is something that we use, and we have both of us have given the seal of approval because we want to do this long-term, and it's something that it works, you know, and we don't do long-term stuff like this, and this is the one that we've chosen, and we love it. So all you guys got to do, don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now, as we've told you 1,000 times, and it's always now. Right now. Get now. Started. For very limited time, Hysteria 51 listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off.
How much?
50%. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your unnatural life.
Wow.
Redeem. How do they do it?
Rashate, you're 50% off. Rashate. Redeem it. 50% off. RosettaStone.com/today. Do it today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
We are back, and I went and picked up the top of my head as it had popped off earlier trying to go through those numbers. But guys,
we wish.
very funny. We talked about the basic paradox is this. The reason it's called a paradox is at the scale of the size of the universe and at the scale of the size of our galaxy, there should be life elsewhere. We have not encountered life elsewhere that's, at least scientifically, like we following the scientific method, provable, repeatable, etc.
The government tells us we got to say that because so many people disagree with that, you know, so the accepted answer is that we have not.
And I mean, we're following the scientific train here. Science has also concluded that we have not yet, because it doesn't follow the scientific method. It's not provable. It's not repeatable.
Right. And also, I mean, like even acquiescing to the arguments that we have been visited by other people before, I think what the basis of the Fermi paradox is that the universe is so big and so old, and the Milky Way at least should be so teeming with life because of all the habitable planets and because of all the time that life has had to evolve, that no government or anyone else could possibly keep it secret.
It
should just be like, we know that there's alien life out there. Like, we know there's a moon. There's just no way to cover it up. And that's where the paradox really kicks in. There's no possibility of a cover up. It should be so plainly evident. And the fact that it's not is what makes the whole thing so weird.
You couldn't walk into the Amazon forest and someone walk up and say, there are no animals around you at all.
Right. Disregard the trees.
I love how they get around that in most, you know, like sci-fi movies and stuff. They go, they found this backwater planet, and that just explains it all. Like, it's in the middle of nowhere. We're just no one's around us, and it's just, you can just explain it away with like that little one line.
Well, it's fun. I guess we are kind of backwater
for sure
comparatively to the center of the galaxy.
Yeah, we're on a spiral arm of a spiral galaxy in the middle of nowhere. Yeah.
So, I mean, we are further away from other stars than some stars are to each other. But again, that doesn't answer the question of the Fermi paradox. So let's tick through some potential answers and just give our thoughts on them and give some background on them.
Some possibilities. Let's start with one here. Life's difficult to start and to evolve to an intelligent and technological advanced stage. We're the only one in the galaxy that has ever done that. Doesn't mean we're alone. But distance and time change. We're the only one here, like close by.
Right. Meaning it's difficult to start. So it, we're not saying it hasn't happened elsewhere, but because it's so
difficult. It happened elsewhere way out there.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that we're the only one, but we might be a small batch,
and
you know.
With the amount of galaxies we talked about, maybe we're the only one in this galaxy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you still run into the same issue as before. I mean, if this was, say, an ancient galaxy or an ancient civilization, that's, you know, we presume that since we're just now starting to kind of wake up and open our eyes and look around, that we would be relatively young. Mm-hmm. We've been around for a very short time compared to the age of the universe. So if life has been able to evolve for the last 10 or 12 billion years, the idea that we're you know, the first ones to kind of wake up, or that the other ones out there are about the same age as us, seems really kind of unlikely. So if they're far, far older, you still run into the same issue. Why haven't they spread out and colonized the rest of the galaxy within, say, 50 million years? We should still know that they're out there, even if they're out there and far away.
It goes in along the line of, like, if really we are the first or in the group of the first, what is that bind that took 13 billion years? Like, there's got to be a, oh, this needs to happen for life, and we just haven't found that yet. You know what I mean? Like, well, yeah. it had to be an explainable thing. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense.
And we mentioned it earlier. Let's talk about that right now then. That's the, there's one hypothesis out there called the rare earth hypothesis. Basically, we look at these kind of macro effects like, oh, are you far enough away from your star to have a decent temperature? And a few other things, and we're like, so there should be so much life. But there's also a combination of a myriad of other things that make some believe that the special mix of everything that we have here on Earth makes us the rare Earth.
When you really kind of start looking at the rare Earth hypothesis, it becomes clear it is so much more than just being in a star's Goldilocks zone is a requirement for life, or not even necessarily a requirement for life, but that the advantages that life on Earth had because of the unique peculiarities of Earth, like plate tectonics, or the fact that there's a giant gas giant that's basically deflecting all of the flotsam and jetsam from space.
Just a big vacuum saving us, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the fact that our moon is way larger relative to the size of our planet than most other moons, which means that we have tides that may have acted as an early laboratory for life to form. There's just, like, that's just a few off the top of my head. Donald Brownlee, in one of his co-authors, wrote a book, an entire book, basically saying, like, here are all the reasons why Earth is totally weird when it comes to sustaining life. And it may be that Earth is the only place in the galaxy and possibly the universe that has this mind-boggling number of factors that all happen to come together to create the conditions for life to arise. Like, maybe all of the ingredients for life are all over the universe, but that doesn't mean that they're going to happen upon one planet where they can have a nice laboratory to come together and grow.
That's a really good point, because if you think about it, we talk about the 10 to the whatever power number of planets out there that should be able to support life based on those macro factors we talked about before. But when you start taking into account all of the smaller factors, which aren't small, I don't mean that. I think I call them smaller factors in the sense that we have such a limited view of our galaxy and universe. We can't tell if this planet, the X that we just discovered so many trillion light years away, even has a moon or not. You know, right. we're using other ways of determining the fact that it's even there. We can't see it. So when you take all of those in plate tectonics, I mean, we're the only, I believe we're the only planet in our solar system that actually has moving plates.
An active volcano.
As far as we know.
Yeah.
And plate that are, most of them are dead as far as that goes.
And you know, you mentioned your moon. I mean, your moon. Your moon and my moon.
It's mine. Last Thursday. Congrats on that again.
I lease it to the rest of the world.
It's only a paper moon. Our
great
moon,
movie.
Yes. The our moon and the fact that it's fixed, which brings not only the tides that you mentioned, but a tremendous amount of stability. So mm-hmm. we don't like wobble and all of those things, I'm sure, are limiting to life if you don't have them. The rare earth hypothesis takes all of those facts. If I was a much smarter person and were able to come up with, you know, huge mathematic algorithms,
I'll handle this.
you would think that as all for the 10 to the whatever power number of civilizations that should exist, you'd probably also think that there's a 10 to the whatever power probability
that
they couldn't.
Start chopping off those powers once you really yes. break down how weird things are. Mm-hmm. Let's move on, though, because we can keep on that forever. Another one is, and this is an important one that is very feasible when you look at the climate of the world today, advanced civilizations destroy themselves on relatively short timescales. You get to the point where they say, like, we are... within 100 years, we'll be a level one civilization. Well, a lot of people say we're never going to get to that level one civilization because we've destroyed our atmosphere, we've destroyed climate, or we will destroy ourselves, like you talked about, with an all-out nuclear war or something along those lines.
Yeah, this to me is the key. I think this is the answer to the Fermi paradox. And to put it in another term, there's an economist named Robin Hanson who basically kind of reformulated the Fermi paradox to basically use it as a guidepost, a signal for the future of humanity. And he called it the great filter. And basically, the great filter is either in our past, meaning we're very, very rare, and that life is not ubiquitous, and it's actually very special and unusual that we're here and in existence. Or the great filter, whatever keeps life from spreading out into the universe so that we know there is other life out there, is in our future, that there's something that happens before an intelligent civilization manages to spread off of its home planet. And if that's the case, if there is a filter that keeps other life or has kept other life thus far from spreading out into the galaxy and the universe, we really want to pay attention to this because there aren't too many steps between where we are now and the point where we will ostensibly leave Earth and spread out. Mm-hmm. So if there's some filter that has wiped out all other life before it could leave its planet, that means that we're going to face the same thing, and we need to figure out what that is. And kind of the basis of the series that I made is that it's this technology coming down the pike that we're taking way too casually, and that it'll be one of those things that wipes us out.
And that's the more pessimistic view.
You could say that.
I suppose.
I would say realistic, but yeah, keep going.
The optimistic view of the great filter is it certainly does exist. And it's past us. We are just one of the few that made it through, or the only that made it through. If everything else being equal, they just haven't. It's not that they haven't made it here. It's just that we're the only one sitting here.
It's so funny how these can tick off so many things. Like you just said, we are the few or the only one. That's why we haven't found anyone. We're the only one, or we're so few. Every one of these you can make such a solid case for. On either direction.
There's a third option on the great filter, I mean, or at least that I would put under the greater category of the great filter. That is, the great filter could actually just be the jump from simple prokaryote cell life to complex eukaryote cell. So it's not that we aren't alone. It's not that there isn't, that the universe isn't, in fact, teeming with life. It's that the great filter was we were able to make the jump and the rest of them can't.
The higher form of life.
Right.
Right. There's a number of steps, actually, that have been identified in our evolutionary past. And, there's the jump from prokaryote to eukaryote. There's the initial one where, you know, for some weird reason, dead molecules came together and formed living self-replicating molecules. Mm-hmm. There is the Cambrian explosion is pointed to as a very unlikely event in the history of life on Earth, where we went from basically simple aquatic bacteria to multicellular body plans like we see on Earth today, almost overnight, geologically speaking. And then you have the development of actual intelligent life, which is us, which as far as we know, we're the only intelligent life in the universe. And there's like 5, 6, 7 steps. And each one of them could have been the great filter in our past, which is an optimistic view. I agree with you. But there's no guarantee, and Robin Hanson points this out, there's no guarantee that the great filter is not in our past and in our future, too.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
There could be multiple great filters. And maybe each one of those is a filter that we've made it through, but we've got this next one coming up before we spread out from our planet.
So not only is it rare that we jump from prokaryote to eukaryote, it's also our own technology is going to kill us.
It's rare that we drug ourselves out of the water, so to speak. It's rare that all these things, it's rare that our planet in and of itself has survived as long as this. Everything leads to everything.
Yeah. And yeah, it's not necessarily that, it's going to be nuclear war, it's going to be AI, and then that's the filter. The great filter being in our future, the idea, the basis of it is that intelligent life gets itself into this precarious position that we're starting to enter now, where it's, to kind of paraphrase Carl Sagan, grown powerful before it's grown wise, meaning that it's developing technology that is way, way more powerful than anything it had before, capable of wiping itself out with. But socially and culturally, it has not developed along the lines enough to use it in a very wise manner. Very much like how we created nuclear energy, and the first thing we did with it was turn it into weapons and start pointing it at each other.
Yeah.
That's a great example of growing powerful before we've grown wise. And now we're starting to develop technology that's even more powerful. It's capable of even more destruction than nuclear technology. And we haven't grown any wiser than we were back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And that is the idea, is that's the great filter, that that an intelligent civilization inevitably gets itself in that situation, and none have survived to this point. And now we, throughout the universe, are the ones that are about to go through the great filter. And the question remains whether we'll make it through or not. It's possible we can, but the chances are it would be very unusual if we actually do.
I was about to make the analogy, it's like letting babies play with knives, but it's actually not. It's like the baby carving out a shiv in their crib and then allowing them, and then they start playing with it because they made it themselves.
Right.
One other thing you mentioned in there, you mentioned taking these dead cells and power or some sort of force that drives them together in a certain form that creates live cells, basically the beginning of life.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you touched on in your series. I remember you mentioning how that actually goes against the laws of the universe, meaning the laws of the universe tend towards chaos.
Right, yeah. It makes zero sense that molecules that are separate and independent and distinct would come together to form increasingly complex forms.
Hold on. I know a famous chaotician who said, life finds a way.
Right? Yeah. And that is a good point. I mean, like, that's proven by the fact that life actually exists. Because if you go back far enough into our evolutionary history, we reach a point where we're like, okay, this makes zero sense. Like, why would this have happened? This doesn't make any sense. And it is such a unique view that there's recently come, I don't remember who came up with this idea, but there's this idea that there is an organizing principle of life in exactly the same way that, you know, we can predict what will happen when something encounters gravity or electromagnetism, that when these dead molecules come together under the right conditions, some organizing principle will take over and actually guide life.
Yeah, I know Stephen Hawking talked about the organizing principles a lot, not just in that, in everything, in as far as time travel and things like that.
Right.
He always talked about there just seems to be this unseeable force, something that guides things, that this is the way it's going to be.
And that sounds very metaphysical too, right? It sounds like, well, you're talking about God. Not necessarily. There's another a school of thought that I came across called digital physics. And it basically says that there is at bottom some very simple, elegant code to the universe, and that ultimately is what drives everything in the universe. It's you could think of it as kind of like the quantum gravity, like marrying the three fundamental forces with gravity, like what string theory seeks to do, kind of. But this is even simpler than that. It's just some very simple bit of code which says that if you put this quark with this quark, it's going to form this. If they're in the neighborhood of one another, they're going to come together. And then when this forms, if it's in the neighborhood of this subatomic molecule, it's going to come together with this thing. It's going to form this. And so you just keep having this increasingly complicated, complex process, creating these large-scale things like us or planets or stars. And that if we understood this code that underlies the whole thing, we could predict everything and all of it would make sense. And that is part of that is this guiding principle of organizing molecules and matter into life. It's just a byproduct of it or an outgrowth of it.
Well, kind of going with that, it was physicist James Gates. He's kind of famous. He was on with Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's the one who was studying the fabric of space and found quote unquote computer code in it. And a lot of people said, like you said, it was, well, that's proof of God. And they're like, well, not really. It might just be proof that there is this code that binds in the universe. Mm-hmm. And we are finding it ourselves as we progress doing, computer simulations and math and things like that, because we're progressing faster in a way than what we can even grasp ourselves.
And the basis, I mean, you said it, the guy who was looking at the fabric of the universe, that's kind of the basis of it, is that if you zoom in far enough into the actual fabric of the universe, what you're going to find are little individual discrete bits, mm-hmm. and they carry information. And then that's that. When you get this bit next to this bit, it's going to form another piece of information, discrete piece of information that's a slightly more complicated, and then so on and so forth and so forth. And then that's how you end up with molecules and then life and planets and all of that stuff.
It's actually written in Cobra. So,
No, it's Python, actually. I checked it.
All right. So
it's C++. That's why it's running so bad.
It's basic.
Yeah.
All right, guys. So we could spend forever on that. Let's get to the next possibility. Now let's talk about some possibilities of life does exist elsewhere. We just haven't seen it yet. First, I'd say on that list is the zoo theory.
That's been popular in the passed around links as of late, that we're a zoo. We're a cosmic zoo. People come by to look at us, and the reason we don't see them is whoever is controlling said universe has just deemed us an oddity.
Well, if they are that far advanced, if they're, a level on the Kardashev scale, if they're a level 2, a level 3 civilization, they could easily stay out of our sight.
Not mine. I'm a level 7, remember?
You're right. <That's
true>. Wow.
he has delusions of grandeur.
Oh, okay.
So the zoo theory, I mean, you can take it in a few different directions, Josh. Any initial thoughts on it?
Yeah, so the zoo theory, just to give a little background, there's a Ohio State astronomer named John Ball who, back in 1973, basically came up with this. And it makes sense. It's very appealing because it reassures us that, yes, there's life out there, and that it's kind of aspirational, too, because these guys are so advanced, they're so intelligent that they don't even care about us. Or they do care about us, and they're keeping us in some sort of preserved state. Or they're kind of keeping an eye on us and waiting for us to reach some level of evolution to where all of the mysteries of the universe are going to be revealed to us, because they're going to contact us and we're going to have basically like a galactic or universal coming out party, like a quinceañera for
Star
humanity.
Star Trek, we need to reach
the prime directive.
Warp before they can talk to us. It's like the whole ants. We're not going to go out of our way to speak to ants until they do something that gets our attention, that goes, oh, they deserve us to be speaking to them.
And a lot of people say that's why we should be messaging out into the universe, because, we're just listening right now. We're not trying to get their attention, really.
Well, we sent a mixtape and a couple nudes a few decades ago.
We did. It was a shot in the dark, though, literally.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly so.
Bouncing off of the zoo theory, there's another possibility that they've heard us. Whatever radio signals we've been at least shooting out, TV radio signals for decades now, and they're on the way.
It just takes a long time,
and that could be part of the great filter.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that ticks off both of those. Right? Yeah, that's a scary one.
There's these things called berserker probes that are kind of this hypothetical idea that if you If you had advanced and wanted the matter and energy in the universe for your own civilization, and you were aware that there were other civilizations out there that were probably going to come later, the easiest thing for you to do would just be to create some probes that you just seeded the universe with to sit dormant, say on like the dark side of the moon, that would come alive when a civilization reach some certain level of evolution or technological sophistication. Say, like, once our electromagnetic signature from, you know, broadcasting triggered it, and then they come alive and then they come and destroy that civilization so that it can't be competition in the future for the original parent civilization.
A competition for resources, competition, eventually grow large enough to be able to fight them, et cetera, et cetera. Just let's just
insert horror. And
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, yeah. Now, let's take that thought process of they are that advanced down a different path. They are so advanced that we've talked about this before on this show. There's certainly a firm belief that if once a civilization gets to level 3 and beyond, that it might just start uploading its entire consciousness to computers
or
whatever.
We might not even recognize it as life anymore, in a way.
But if it does upload itself to what its version of a computer is, then we get to the estivation hypothesis. And what that is, and Josh, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but
I looked up the Estevez hypothesis. I was totally off on that.
A super intelligent race of Emilio.
But you saw some great movies along the way.
That's true.
Yeah. Young Guns 2 is my favorite.
We're all going to die from a flying V, you know, so that's the way it's going to go.
Did you hear that one of the kids from that movie just got arrested for like stealing stuff so he could go buy drugs or something? Like,
how long is your Mighty Ducks money going to last?
Well, I mean, there
crack ain't free, baby.
Weren't there 17 sequels? I don't know.
There was a few. You're right.
Anyway, all right. So back to
we digress.
The estivation hypothesis is essentially this: once you build a computer large enough to hold the data that is your entire civilization's consciousness, that computer, all computers emanate heat to one extent or another, and when it gets large enough and enough heat is being shot out there, that eventually becomes a bad thing. Whether it's a bad thing because it gets too hot and you can't cool it down even in the depths of space, or you're a lot more seeable to other civilizations. So the thought process is that we know that the universe is entropic, or at least we think it is, so that the universe will eventually cool and cool and cool and cool, so that they are essentially going into hibernation until the day comes that the universe is cool enough that they can run their machine and live on their civilization. Mm-hmm. Did I butcher that well enough, Josh?
No. I mean, a post-biological civilization will eventually run into a waste heat problem. Yeah. And the estivation hypothesis, estivation is what an animal does when it basically hibernates because it's hot, not because it's cold. And the estivation hypothesis is that a post-biological society would say, okay, we're going to wait until, like you said, the universe cools down, gets closer and closer to the heat death of the universe, so that it's way cooler, meaning that computation is going to be way more efficient, which is, you know, for a post-biological society, that's the lifeblood, is the computing speed, processing speed. And so they will actually hibernate. They will estivate, I guess, for a million or a billion or several billion years. And then they'll wake up so that at the point where the computing will be most efficient. But in the meantime, they need to protect their claim that they've staked while they're sleeping.
Thus, it might be a combination of both that and the Berserker probes.
Yeah.
Right. So the Berserker probes would kind of keep an eye out for any new, young, upstart civilizations that might come about while this post-biological society is hibernating, and it would wipe them out. So now, that kind of ties into the original Berserker probe theory.
The interesting thing about this is we're looking at this with the concept of, you know, technology, everything we do produces heat and things like that. We're using it with the eyes that we have. When you're talking about a type 2 or type 3 civilization that is actually, we say colonizing, and it kind of goes along with that, it doesn't mean that they might be physically colonizing. The entire concept of physical colonization might be backwards to them. We don't know what that might unlock when we can harness all of the power of our host sun, our host universe, things like that. When you step into type 2 and type 3s, maybe that doesn't even matter anymore. The heat, we've come up with a way that that isn't a thing. I know that that sounds made up, but it's all made up because we don't know.
That's a really good point, though. And I think a lot of people, when they're making arguments about this kind of stuff, that their imaginations end somewhere in human level. And it's a really great mental exercise, at least, to say, well, we're thinking from, you know, the human mind. We're not thinking from, you know, a post-biological type 2 or type 3 civilization's mind. Well, who knows what they'd be capable of? So, yeah, waste heat might not be an issue, but they are going to need material and resources and energy to carry out that computation.
Right.
And so they do have reason to continue to spread out and colonize further and further as they need more and more and more. And if they're harnessing the energy of a star or a galaxy, that should leave some sort of telltale sign even while they're sleeping, because you would assume that they're going to keep trying to harness energy or keep mining material. And we should be able to see that somehow.
We need to learn how to, what we're looking for.
Well, and so taking that a step further, maybe we're just the only idiots out there broadcasting
spewing.
Out. Yeah. You know, the other civilizations that have come to our level and beyond, they know that there are these huge predator civilizations out there.
It's like mortal engines on a planetary scale.
You do not send these
civil Darwin, space Darwinism, you know.
Yeah, you do not send these signals out, because they will come get you, and we just weren't smart enough to realize that. And then I suppose the one that, before we go to break, that we should mention is that a portion of all of this is true, but they have been here. They are here. The government is just that good.
They're just hiding it.
They're hiding it.
Yeah. I mean, it started with a crash that was a weather balloon way back in the 40s, and they've been in contact, and they're hiding it from us for our own good. Gentlemen, is what it really amounts to.
Tough to argue with.
That's what the government does at all times, right? Everything's for our own good.
They take my money because it's for my own good.
For your own good, yeah.
You know, they dictate what I can do for my own good.
All right. That's how it works. They create chemtrails for your own good.
Well, you know, you can't have all straight frogs, you know? That's
what Alex Jones says. Yeah. All right, guys. Enough of that. When we come back, let's head to break. When we come back, let's look at a few of the more out there theories.
These ones have been real easy to grasp. Yeah. Yeah.
And then we'll wrap up with, let's take a look at Occam's razor. What makes the most sense, which you might or might not like.
Ooh.
That's after the break on Hysteria 51.
Josh, we got a double JJ this week on we other possibilities. What do you guys, what are some other possibilities?
We referenced this earlier. The universe could be teeming with life. We were weirdly rooted in carbon-based life. Mm. What if there is life on all these gas giants? Yeah. I mean, we wouldn't really even know how to detect it.
Or what if it's just kind of looking us in our face and we don't see it for what it is, you know? Like, what if life is just an emergent property of some complex system? And we think it has to be a talking, communicating thing, but, you know, I hate to cite it, but there's that whole Gaia hypothesis that the Earth in its own way is a system that is larger than the sum of its parts. It doesn't mean that, you know, the Earth is going to sit up and talk to us and be like, actually, you want to tilt your telescope
over there.
It's more
like a reef. It's more like a reef.
Very much so, right?
Millions of minute organisms creating one larger complex one.
Or like a hive mind, you know, like we look at a hive mind and we see that there's this very sophisticated, basically an artificial intelligence is what you would call it. But we don't think of it as life. We think of it as, you know, actually it's stemming from all these different lives. Well, what if that's not necessarily true? What if life has more sophisticated layers than we are aware of? The universe is teeming with life in that sense.
That actually feels very right in a weird sort of way, too, because going with the hypothesis that we aren't the smartest things out there, like we only have a study set to look from of one. sample set. So, like, just the idea that we don't know what we don't know always appeals to me.
I read something interesting recently. They're talking about different types of life, and it whole went on to the paranormal and ghost things, and how some life that we don't know how to reach, or some others are just shifted from us. So we catch these glances of life that we just don't realize is life, and that's what we say is paranormal or things like that.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it's just on this veil of existence that is out of tune with us, and that is just something that is, we might be the ones that are actually out of tune,
right?
You know what I mean? And
that's
everything
like
else
the others. Did you ever see that movie The Others with Nicole Kidman?
No.
Yes.
Oh
yes.
I'm not going to spoil it then, John.
Oh, just it's a great spoil
right
though.
When you stop today, go watch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. My wife likes that kind of stuff. We will. Well, it's got Nicole Kidman, so she'll be fine. All right, so guys, another one. Let's go back to an earlier hypothesis. It's not that life can't exist elsewhere, but maybe we're the only one in this galaxy that it's so rare that in this galaxy, yeah, we're pretty much the only one that it happened to. We haven't even talked about the fact that we don't know how dangerous travel between galaxies is.
Well, we know that just travel in our nearby space is incredibly dangerous.
Right.
Radiation and, mm-hmm, and just the effects on the body, the drying out of your eyes, and the effects it has on your muscles, the effects it has on everything.
We don't know
it's
what
crazy.
We don't really know what extragalactic space is like.
That's a good word that doesn't get used enough, extragalactic.
And that there could be a limiting factor there. There could be some sort of limiting factor that, okay, within your galaxy maybe, but outside of that, good luck.
Mm-hmm. That's entirely possible, but it has the flaw that just about every argument against the Fermi paradox has, or the idea that we aren't the only ones out there has. And that is that, like, if you're talking about potentially trillions of civilizations that have developed, and some of which have survived over the years and they're still out there, that not a single one of them, as advanced as they've gotten, has figured out how to get around whatever issue this is.
Right.
Right. Right. No, that's a good point.
That's a big flaw, because, I mean, that's a lot of chances to give it a shot, a lot of different perspectives and paradigms to approach the issue from, and that not one of them has figured it out. And also take into account that, you know, these are issues for us. We've been to the moon, basically. That's what we've done as ourselves. The farthest we've been is the moon. We're babies when it comes to the idea of something like interstellar or intergalactic travel. So it's kind of the same thing, where we're looking at these problems through the minds of an extraordinarily young, intelligent civilization. If even a civilization that has a million-year head start on us, or a 100,000-year head start on us, imagine what humanity could do in 100,000 years, mm-hmm, if we keep at trying to get off of Earth.
I mean,
you can make the same argument for any other civilization out there that has that kind of head start on us.
Now, give them a million years.
Right.
You know, or whatever they might have had.
Let's go down a completely different path then. The path of, we truly don't understand our own reality. Now, that could be something as simple as, we did an episode on this before. Josh, I know you've talked about it numerous times in various places, simulation theory. So, you know,
we don't understand it because we physically cannot. It's ingrained into the code that we just will not be able to figure
out.
Right.
We're alone because we're the only one that was programmed so far by the junior in college.
Yeah, we're sitting on a desk somewhere with a C minus and it says see me next to it. You know,
anything from simulation theory to the entirety of existence is a hologram to, I mean, these are more out there concepts, but the overlying point being, no matter which one is true or you believe in or whatever, we truly just don't understand our reality.
Right. Well, and I always think it's funny with the whole simulation theory, not funny, an interesting way to put onto it is, we talked about before, is it looking like a simulation because the universe is broken down into these codes that, like we talked about, that it's just so structured that it falls in line with what we would think of as a code, a simulation, things like that. It also goes down the whole theological debate. Well, it's a simulation because that's how the deity, you know, God or whoever you have, created it that way. And that's the way that they made it, and we're in a simulation because they have simulated us in that way. Or is it just all BS?
And Josh, do you the idea that we don't perceive our reality in the correct way being an explanation for the Fermi paradox, does that hold more or less water?
I don't know that the simulation theory necessarily says that we incorrectly perceive our reality. It's basically saying like we... Like, it's reality to us. It's a simulation to whoever's simulating it. But to us, it's reality. Everything that we share this simulated universe with is as real as we are. And so it doesn't actually serve as an answer to the Fermi paradox, because all of the same questions and all of the same scenarios and all the same situations can all still take place
into a container, but everything's still there.
Plus, yeah, it really just kind of kicks the idea up one more level. Like, it doesn't tell us about anything outside of the simulation. Like, are there aliens outside of the simulation? Are the physics the same outside of the simulation? And even if we start to try to explore those larger questions, we're still stuck with the same questions in here.
It always reminds me of an old episode of Star Trek Next Generation where Data liked to play as Sherlock Holmes. And he he'd solve it immediately. It wasn't fun. So he goes, well, what if we turned the simulation, they can turn it up and make it more realistic, set it to like maximum level, which was like his level of intelligence. Mm-hmm. He goes back in and immediately Moriarty realizes he's in a simulation. Literally. So he realizes and he watches them like, computer and hope. So he takes over the ship and they end up tricking him by putting him into a larger simulation. He could go out and explore the universe on his own without realizing he's in the simulation. What happens when he figures out he's in that simulation? You know what I mean? It's one of those things.
When you were younger, did you want anything more than to have a holodeck?
Oh, right. Right. Yes.
Still working on that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. But Brent, you mentioned this earlier in the conversation about simulation theory. I think it's worth exploring. It's an entire episode, so we will just do it for a moment, but it's worth pointing out the God question. Let's just say, Brent and I have talked about on the show, Josh, that we both actually do believe in God, but there are different types of gods you can believe in. You can believe in the magic wand God who walks around and with the magic wand and goes, poof, there's a tree, and versus this omnipotent entity that just breathes a breath of something to get everything rolling, and then the Big Bang takes over, and then evolution takes over, and so on and so forth. No matter what God you believe in, if God exists, it's interesting because it could explain both sides of that coin, right? It's not an answer for the Fermi paradox. Some people argue that it is. They say that we're alone, and it's because it's God's will.
Right.
Well, actually, God could exist and just have created the universe with that breath, that organizing principle, that organizing force, and then let things go from there.
That's the exact same thing as the simulation argument too, basically.
Right.
It doesn't answer or change anything because, okay, God created it. Now we still have all those same questions.
I just thought it was worth bringing up that some people say that the God question answers the Fermi paradox. They're taking a very limited scope on it. Well, God just only created us, and that's just a very, very limited view of the universe, of a universe created by God. Even
I didn't create you, turds.
No.
that's category seven talking right there.
Word.
All right, guys. Before we wrap, let's get to the final one.
Sweet. Are we battling or just
rap battle?
Okay.
Snap back to reality. Occam's razor would tell us.
That's Occam.
Yes. Thank you for the correct pronunciation.
We're going to say Fermi. We're going to say Occam.
Occam's razor would tell us that we're completely alone, whether it be by intelligent design, the rarity of life developing, or just bad timing.
We're either late to the party or we're there fashionably early.
Right?
It's our party. We're throwing it later.
But regardless of the reason, we are completely alone on this little blue dot.
I used to be of the mind that the universe is just so astoundingly and incomprehensibly big that it's not possible we're the only life, intelligent life. And then I started kind of researching this more and more and more, and I actually came to a different conclusion that it seems pretty likely that we actually are. As even more astounding as that idea is, it seems like the likeliest conclusion because it requires the least amount of mental acrobatics, I guess, is how I'd put it, to get to that conclusion. It explains everything else. It's just we're alone. And it's depressing, but in the same way, it's also really kind of uplifting because that means we have the entire universe right there for our taking. We're never going to go to war with somebody over some planet that we want to harvest for its material. It's just ours. The more we get to advance technologically and the more we spread out, the more we will be able to take advantage of it and do amazing things with
it. That took a deliciously evil turn. It's ours. Like, I love that. It's like, we want to go to another planet. It's ours.
You have to grip the air and make a fist when you say it.
Exactly.
Like
it's like the Eddie Izzard thing. It's like, do you have a flag? They don't even need a flag. It's ours. It's ours. It's just ours. It's the way it goes. I like that.
And you know what? I have to admit, it might not be my thought on it. We'll get to our thoughts in just a second. Our ultimate, you know, wrapping thoughts. But I have to admit that Occam's Razor is in the top couple of the most most likely here, right? Like,
it's one or the other.
I mean, but I mean, yeah. I'm saying in the sense that, like, using all of the available evidence that we have, of course, it makes the most sense because. Going back to the original query of the paradox, where are they? They should be right here, you know?
They should be. Getting into our thoughts about that, it's a tough one for me. I wrestle with this a lot because I research so much of the extraterrestrial experiences and things like that, and I look at the big picture, and it's hard to say. It is fun to think that we're the only ones there in a way, but it's also crazy because I'm more of your original thinking. It's so vast that you put a monkey in front of a typewriter long enough, he'll give you Shakespeare. You know, you throw enough.
True?
Well, Shakespeare. It's close. It's not okay, exactly right, the same.
We haven't found a monkey old enough yet. We're still working on it.
I saw something, and it was actually interesting. It was a dryer, and the door was open, and all the laundry was folded. And they're like, by the, you know, the rules of everything,
chance.
Sometime you should open your dryer, and this is what's inside there. And I'm like, oh, that's
man, that'd be nice.
But that's the exact same way, though. Looking at life. Is it that big of a chance? Well, when you have hundreds of billions or we're getting into trillions when you get into the whole big thing of other planets and things like that, could there be life? I like to think so.
Here's your out. Yes, it exists. It's just another dimension.
Well, that's what I was kind of saying. Like, and that's so frustrating. Will we ever figure it out? That's the big thing. You know, there's so many experiencers out there in one way or another that have seen ghosts or aliens or things like that. You can't write all of them off. Now, it doesn't mean what they experience is what they said they experienced, but a lot of them are telling the truth. Now, a lot of that could be government, could be things, it could be all sorts of the gamut. But it's just a fun thing to think for me, the what if, and to keep that open. Maybe that's just wishful thinking. I just like the what if.
I agree. I think the what if is definitely always worth examining and pursuing. Even if you don't necessarily agree with it, it's still worth thinking about.
Yeah, because I don't want to, you know, well, that's what science is. It's it's saying, what if we did this? What if we did that? What if we slammed these particles together? What if we tried to go to the moon? What if we tried to send out signals? We don't know the answer, and that's what's fun about it, and that's what's frustrating at the same time.
And science is meant to examine new evidence as it comes in to make sure that its existing ideas still hold up under you know, the new evidence that came in.
No matter what the answer is, people 1,000 years from now, if they're able to access this podcast, will be laughing at us.
I already am.
But, yeah, because these idiots.
If there was a podcast going on when they were talking,
Josh on.
If there was a podcast going on when they were talking about heliocentrism, and
looking at the climate today, I'm surprised that's not a podcast.
Or the Earth is. I mean. How many people were literally killed for believing that the Earth was round and that we weren't the center of the universe? Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the levels of understanding that the degrees of understanding that we have established. Here's where I come out on it. I don't know the answer to the question. We've talked numerous times before about our beliefs on this show, and I've always said I believe in aliens, but I don't believe that they've been here. And I think that goes back to the vastness of space. I think it's hubris. Of us as species to think that if they do exist, we have to be aware. I mean, think about it this way. We talked about grains of sand before. If we are a grain of sand, and don't even take the 10,000 for every grain of sand. If we were a grain of sand on the eastern coast of Australia, okay, and the grain of sand was our world, and we're little microbes that are floating around on that grain of sand, we have a certain line of visibility, and we might even have tools that extend that line of visibility. But how far are they? How far are those tools going to extend? Perth? I mean, like
that was just an excuse to
say Perth. Yeah, you're right. but how far? Like literally, how much could we see? What would we know about a grain of sand on the coast of California? Mm-hmm. Nothing. We would know absolutely nothing. We'd have no way to see it. We'd have no way of understanding what was happening over there, the environment that it was like, and we might not ever run across them. Now, maybe we figure out a way to get picked up by the wind and get carried over there and interact with them at some point. But at the same time, like, we are just so infinitesimal in the universe. I have a hard time wrapping my head around it being just completely impossible. That's kind of where
I think
a
lot of people have the problem with, you know, we are so small and infinitesimal. People want to feel special. I think that's inherently human. And so thinking that we're just this vast ocean of crazy is somehow defeating to them.
But when you think about what we don't know, think about this. We don't even know if there is another planet in our solar system. Gravity tells us there probably is that we haven't even seen it yet. Mm-hmm. And I'm not talking about Pluto, hashtag Team Pluto.
Yeah, you know, there's a SETI researcher named Jill Tarter, who Jodie Foster's character was based on in Contact.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, you know, our searches so far for intelligent life are so small and insignificant. It's kind of like dipping a cup of water into the ocean, coming up with nothing and proclaiming that there's no life in the ocean. And that's a great point. I mean, that makes a really great point that we are really early on in our searches. For me, the fact that we have not been made aware one way or another, that's what really sells it for me. But I think what you were saying, it was very well put and beautiful and very persuasive too. It is just, it's possible that we are being kept out of awareness somehow, or we just can't be aware at this point because we're still so early in our advancement.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nation, that's what we think. Why don't you tell us what you think?
Yeah, hop on Hysteria Nation. Just go to Facebook, search Hysteria Nation. You can let us know what you think. You can let us know how much you enjoyed Josh on the show, or you can let us know how much you hate CBOT, because that's always fun to do.
They are smarter than that.
And don't forget, facebook.com/hysteria51pod. That is our normal page. Tweet to us at hysteria51pod. Also, Instagram, Patreon, patreon.com/hysteria51. Josh, we have an awesome, awesome level I want to tell you about for $30.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now,
if you come to one of our meetups, which we do a lot, you can smell John Goforth for
$30. It's not true. You can't.
It is, and we have had two people sign up for it. We've had two people sign up for it. I think that is, it's worth it. It's a good use of their money.
I'd pay $35 for that.
See? Exactly. Exactly. So if you want to smell John Goforth or get a t-shirt or some crap like that, I mean, you can do that on Patreon also. But
if you forget any of that except for the sniffing part, because that's not true, go to hysteria51.com for all the links to everything.
It's true.
Josh, we can't thank you enough for your time today.
Thanks to you guys. I really appreciate you guys having me on. This was fascinating.
It was such a fun. I love these topics are so fun because there's no wrong. Well, like you said, in 1,000 years looking back, but right now there's no wrong answer. That's what's so fun. You can just kind of go, yeah, this is what I think, or this is what helps me sleep at night, I mm-hmm. guess is one way to put it.
And Josh, before we go, tell us the deets on both The End of the World, Stuff You Should Know. Where can they find you if they somehow haven't yet? Give us your lowdown.
Okay, so on social, we're typically SYSK Podcast, and I'm Josh Clark, because I say a lot. And I also have a hashtag going, hashtag EOTW Josh Clark, where I talk about stuff that's related to existential risks and end of the world and all that.
That's awesome.
So it's just a fun one. Just right. Comedy galore, right? Yeah.
You know,
it's chuckle fest.
The one thing I'll say, if you haven't listened to The End of the World yet, you really need to.
No, it is. Yeah, it's, really.
Thank you.
Because you kind of beautifully arrange it, even though you're talking about these fairly negative or yes, it's negative. The end of mankind is negative, but you arrange it kind of like in a way that feels almost positive and uplifting, and striking that chord or that balance is amazing, and something I'm sure certain I couldn't have done. So kudos to you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate
now,
that.
Now, real quick, what would it cost to smell you? Just out of curiosity.
I don't know. I've never considered that.
Don't. It's okay. You know what? Just ignore him.
I bet it's over $30, you cheap. Never mind.
I think you are giving it away way too cheaply, John.
Oh, so that's been the Fermi Paradox. With that said, I've been Brent.
I've been Josh.
I've been John.
He's been Conspiracy Bot.
Stay woke, meet sex.
It was terrible. It was just terrible. I'll never get over it as long as I live.
That's it for another edition of Hysteria 51. John and Brent will be back next week with yet more of the unexplained, the unexplored, and the unheard of. Oh, if it's unheard of, how will they know about it? Anyway, if you want to suggest a topic, give us your thoughts, or just make fun of Conspiracy Bot, that's my favourite, join us in our Facebook discussion group, Hysteria Nation. Just log on to Facebook and search Hysteria Nation, or you can always tweet us at Hysteria51Pod.
You've been listening to a fourth-hand joint.